So we have two things we'd like to talk about tonight, the next few minutes, Marshall. And one is three or four generic observations you would make. First, for the hospital or medical people in Atlantic City, and then after that, for the Time Incorporated seminar dry run on the 25th. So we're asking initially what would be the essential message, three or four principal points which you would like to see communicated to these medicos and hospital managers and representatives.
Well, that's a bit presumptuous, but the theme that we've often discussed, Ralph, is that the business of a hospital is to save the patient's time. It's not to make people well. It's to get them out of there in 3 days instead of 3 weeks if possible, just as the teacher's business is to save the student's time. Anybody can learn anything if he has long enough, but the teacher's job is to accelerate the learning process to the point where he can really save some time. But perhaps in hospitals in general, the older pattern that had grown up unconsciously was strong centralizing of functions, services, and the new pattern tends to be exactly the opposite, strong decentralizing of services and functions. And service industries in general tend to take this pattern because their job is, after all, tailor-made, custom-oriented toward the needs of the individual. A centralized service or center is naturally slanted toward the needs of the administration rather than of the patient. And for example, the whole new stress in somebody like Dick Grantley Reed's, you know, Childbirth Without Fear, the whole reversal takes the form of considering the patient rather than the, well, I suppose, the convenience of the doctor, or even taking a father into consideration as undergoing trauma during childbirth. But I think that general reversal of direction, the decentralizing, moving hospital services toward the needs of the patient away from the advantage and consideration of the staff, is a pattern which affects all forms of industry and of service and organization of energy in our time. It's quite a surprising reversal.
I think, interestingly, from what I've been able to observe, it seems to be the interest of the patient and the doctor as opposed to the institution.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well,
that's a good point.
Yeah. And the doctor had identified earlier with the institution than the patient had. So he tended to be a little more.
More recognition of both of them.
Yeah.
The doctor won't come out. He's, there's this difference. An interesting thing in relation to time when you speak of the hospitals, how in one sense the hospitals are still functioning under pre-electric conditions,
mm-hmm.
and that goes in terms of electric light. Mm-hmm. Why do they get patients up early in the morning? Mm-hmm. The whole scheduling of doing everything is related to the days before electricity, electric light. The whole time question you speak of.
That's a good point, Tony. That it's not any longer necessary to set the gears according to daytime, but time can be programmed according to electric light.
My wife used to be especially vehement about this when we were both working for General Electric, Tony, and she was in a research and development sector. And she used to say to the management there, look, General Electric people, you have literally transformed day and night. by the sheer provenance of that electric bulb up there, and why do you insist upon adhering to the calendar and the chronology of something that has by itself become a kind of anachronism, where actually you can rescore and rescale the day to suit human convenience and not to adhere to a time-honored and people's favorite system, so to speak?
This tendency to decentralize and therefore to bring all services within the range of the individual rather than of the administrator is characteristic of many areas of electric servicing, including the book, you see, with xerography. The reader becomes publisher instead of the publisher becoming the centralized service agency.
You know, in that light, I was thinking in relation to the packaging problem that the reader can become the producer of the user can become the producer of the package with electricity. The consumer can have the machine and determine the package he wants. He can electrically question the packaging company. They can electrically supply the answer, which is made in his own plant, in his own place.
Yeah.
It is almost similar. The beginnings of this go back to the roll of wrapping paper, you know, which was an attempt to send out packaging here. Form your own packaging by hand, but now it can be done the same design and custom making of a package. One could type in their needs to the company, and the company electrically send back the full.
There is an amazing new possibility too, you see, in the as a result of cellophane transparency. When the packaging becomes transparent, the contained objects have to take on a new dimension. They're so visible regardless of whether they're wrapped or not. They have to have a new character. They have to be more acceptable in their rough and ready form, as it were. And cellophane, the translucency in packaging creates a completely new dimension, and it's not unrelated to sound, because sound is more
packaging.
You hear these ads for the meat and the AMP, they say the worst side is up.
And now the oranges have to become more orangey, the apples have to become more apple-y, so to speak, and everything has to take on a coloration that even transcends that's what it had in nature in the first place.
I'm sure that it's worth meditating a bit on this strange dimension of translucency for wrapping paper. It has, in many examples, though, reached a state of great inconvenience. Have you ever noticed how difficult it is to remove cellophane from many products? Darned hard. You need a razor blade to even touch the stuff. They haven't quite accepted.
Especially when
unwrapping can become embarrassing, too.
Especially when seeing on with one of those objects that looks like the old curly iron.
Yes,
the girls
yes.
used to use them in their hair, and they brush it across, and it.
But it becomes a noisy thing that becomes embarrassing. Really sound.
In public.
But to return to another point, Marshall, what would you say apropos of the hospital and the doctors, staff, and administration about environment and anti-environment, about the world in which they dwell, but which they cannot see?
Part of the revolution of modern medicine is that most hospital space, 38% of all hospital space, is reserved for patients recovering from therapy. And therapy, as therapy takes on tremendous new dimensions, it also lays low many more patients than formerly. And so the largest proportion of all hospital services are occupied helping people recover from treatment.
Which they've already had.
Which treatment which has been already given to them. So that such is the potency of antibiotics and these various prophylactics and so on, but they lay low most patients.
It's interesting. In light of this, if we notice this idea of publishing becoming individual, there seems to be much more outpatient treatment, of treatment of the patients in the home, in the within their own community.
And through the druggist.
And through the druggist, and through the interestingly, when you say that, I was thinking through drugs, but the druggist becomes the same thing.
Right.
For instance, like Saranac used to be a place people went for a TB. No longer exists,
right.
You know?
Now houses a management school, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, well, that's another example of decentralizing, isn't it, of medication services and therapy. The possibility, well, even, of course, aspirin and whatnot permits decentralization, extremist form.
It's interesting, the manufacturing of drugs takes on that role.
LSD, however, is a drug being used for the therapy of people afflicted by environments. It's a cure for environmental
malaise
and saturation. It's, it yanks you out of the environment as if on a trip.
Yeah.
And this kind, extending the drugs all the way into the psychic domain, is a curious one. I'm not sure how far it is to be taken seriously or sanctioned, how far to be implored or deplored. However, I think we've covered the beat about the hospital. The whole tendency is this decentralizing. As many, many services become available in many, many places, there's not the same need to rush off the hospital. On the other hand, notice that one of the overwhelming facts about hospital is that it's team play. That the medical man goes to the hospital because he can depend upon elaborate teamwork to aid him in any therapy, whatever. It's no longer, it's not only decentralized, but it's corporate rather than private activity.
And it really has precipitated and even sanctioned, as Benny Mullertime would say, new work forms where men cohere and collaborate intelligently on a single problem,
mm-hmm.
so that the original fragmentation of the work or of the operation.
Well,
right?
Bernie's point, too, was that in the operating room you have a high level of coordinated, orchestrated team play.
Right.
Whereas in the area of ordinary hospital care, you have the more obsolete types of organized or mal-organized functions.
Then there's a kind of rude disparity within the organization of the hospital itself as between the coordinating team of surgeons, which is streamlined and immediate and intelligently coordinated, versus the rather serialized, routine, old-fashioned kind of approach to...
In other words, the operating room is run operationally,
right.
And the patient care is run bureaucratically.
One is made to save time, and the other is made to spend time.
All right.
Right.
Very good. Let's switch over.
Could we stop for a moment?
Sure.
Yeah.
No, I don't want to put those observations down. For
no, but this is completely private, Marshall, and it's to the point, actually, because this helped provide the...
Well, it was only yesterday that we were having words from another type of organization in which they pointed out their horror, lest they become bureaucratized and rigid and brittle and lose their flexibility.
Right.
And today we were living with the same, those very unfortunate characteristics, a highly skilled and highly expert bunch.
But a very narrow expertise.
That had begun to be self-complacent and self-satisfied, and which had no power, self-criticism or self-observation, no power of flexibility, innovation. And in other words, a bunch of people who just about had it.
Does this come in any way from their relation to print?
and hi-fi photography.
Marshall felt very, very uncomfortable with these people, with the same kind of sensitivity that you have.
That's what I told you.
Yeah, right.
They were not unfriendly. They were only too eager.
They're very personable. These are good guys, you know.
And in life at home, fine. Yeah. But you're not dealing with them at home.
Precisely.
You're dealing with them in an area that they are holding on to.
That's
and
right.
The freewheeling receptiveness we found in this other organization, where there was an eager exchange and a subtle byplay and a quick apprehension of what Marshall was driving at, and then a rejoinder and a question and a dialogue.
You know,
none of this.
Interestingly, you would find response at Look or at the Herald Tribune, but not at Time.
Uh-huh.
Let's be explicit. Look was what we were talking to.
Oh, see, I can see it in a magazine.
Yeah.
You see, they are, life is lost. Life is deadly.
Right.
Life is lost at this time.
Life is death.
Life is a horrible magazine at this point. It's not revealing anything. It's trying to perpetuate a
dead past.
It's trying to perpetuate their own ideas instead of looking at life and getting ideas,
right.
As opposed to Look, which is opening up as a magazine.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I just can see it in the pages, and that's why I said you wouldn't find this there without knowing anything.
You two are very sensitive men. This is exactly what has been haunting Marshall these few days. We've been talking to both these people, Marshall as principal here, and the verve, the reciprocity, the sense of exploration and vitality.
Life magazine.
But he found
not,
the one.
You know, this
was
is
lacking
interesting.
The other.
What are your attitudes and so forth to photography? What do you think about the picture?
Oh well, it's many. It's many dimensions. It's many kinds of things, and of course, right here the pictures on your wall represent a range which could be comprehended within the life orbit, for example, but within their organization as a administrative unit, it's their insistence on keeping those very kinds of pictures in different departments, classified, separate, distinct. They wouldn't allow them to overlap. They'd have exact names and classifications of those pictures. And they've got reached that advanced state of classification which makes dialogue among their enterprises or among their departments very difficult. And so, as we move into the TV age, where the photographic dimensions become rather lo-fi and overlaid, this hi-fi effect becomes alien to their whole needs.
What do you mean by hi-fi?
Well, hi-fi means a lot of fill-in of data, where there's an enormous amount of data filled into the picture, as compared with, say, cartoon, where there's hardly any data, just a bounding line. See, somewhere in between there you have lo-fi. Lo-fi is the world of the old buggy in the fog.
What we saw this afternoon.
Steichen is lo-fi man. He experimented with lo-fi, low definition. Low definition involves the sense of touch. You can feel it. You can handle it. Steichen was a great.
He evokes a response from the perceiver that the hi-fi doesn't, because what we saw this afternoon, and they were pridefully showing this.
Now, let me give you examples right there. The lower picture, the gal. Strong contour in the profile. Above it, strong sense of play and action involvement. Over here on the left, much kinetic, you see, the involvement of the muscular as well as the imagery. That is lo-fi or low definition because it involves the non-visual senses. Where the non-visual senses come into play, touch and action. You know, one of these Polish jokes is about, do you know why Poles are humpback and have flat heads? Because when you ask them a question, they hump their backs, and when they tell them the answer, they flap their head. This is the involvement of the other senses, non-visual. So where the non-visual senses come into play, you have lo-fi photography, which is very satisfying to the ordinary customer. He likes that.
And this afternoon, Marshall and I were taken into a kind of muniment room or a secret storage room where they had these color photographs used to pictorialize the books now in the process of being made. And Tony, the colors screamed at you and the lines leaped out at you, didn't they? One after
another.
Very high
five. Here,
nothing
by the way, this picture over here you see is only partly visual. The posture and the relation of the bodies there is non-visual. It's touch.
Right.
Now, in sound, there are equivalent effects, as you know. And this hi-fi sound would exclude touch or interplay of bodies or interplay of forces and would insist on just one instrument effect at a time. That's fragmentation, that's hi-fi, when you just stress one kind of quality at a time. No dialogue, no interplay. Now, what are we working on?
This, and if I can relate it in sound, this is related to, in sound, to the person being more interested in the sound, or in the old terms, I don't know, the medium, rather than the message. Or I'm using
massage.
No, it is when he's more interested in the in what he's copying than what he's communicating.
Or what effect he's having.
Yes, well, that's what I mean by the when he has no attitude towards or relation to what he's copying. And no point of view in relation, no attitude, I think, is proper. No attitude towards what he's copying. Interestingly, I can show you an interesting example of this. In recordings I have made of foreigners, the foreigners love them. In the recordings that are made by the standard commercial places of foreigners, they hate them. And I'll tell you why. When I have at least realized that in our culture, when I'm recording a song, I want to hear the song. I have an attitude or an approach to the recording of this. Now, if you listen to most recordings of African music and so forth are made by people who do not understand the language. And they see the words just as important as the drum or anything else. And they forget that it's a language. And they forget what there is being communicated by this. And they treat everything as sound, as this getting interest in getting everything clearly. Everything equally and everything clearly. And not they're
knowing the relationship between sound and voice.
I'm in a relationship between the people, what they're trying to say, how people are hearing this, what they are going to get out of it, and so forth. I have an attitude towards it. A relation to it.
You see, Batman is a world of sharp contour, like that lower picture over there, the gal with her white...
That's Rena.
Is it? Mm-hmm. What, you see, there you have a world of contour, sharp outline. That's Batman, which is the world of cartoon rather than the world of pictorial fill-in. And in sound terms, this means the sudden shock or interface of quite distinct sounds. Which that's what I meant when I told you that the soundtrack in Dr. Zhivago is very iconic or cartoon-like. There's no gradation, there's no build-up, there's no gradualness. It's just wham, bang, like a Batman, you know, crunch, zam, what do they call some of those words?
Pow.
Pow. The zap-pow. It's tactile. It's interface. Touch means interface. That's what touch is. It's interface. It's not a separate sense. It's the meeting of senses. So when sight and sound meet, you get this sort of cartoon world. That's the mystery, of course, of the cave drawings. Those outlines in the caves have this mysterious power of creating images of enormous involvement. The bounding line on the image is so thick that it brings in the whole human sensorium. The thicker the bounding line, just like the Japanese pen, brings in all the senses, including sound. I think we've had it. Sorry.
In relation to time, see, the areas I begin to think of is that, you know, how they are going, that they are going into other areas of communication, their books, their audiovisual areas, and I feel that they are going into them without any
understanding.
Real understanding of developing this sensory perception.
Intersensory. They don't want this interplay. They like to keep everything in separate categories.
Oh, Marshall, tell Tony, which I thought was very interesting, about Noam Ross's conception of the new city. Oh, this is rich.
Time is cooperating with a group of builders who are setting up experimental cities.
For the first time in history, literally, Tony, experimental cities.
That is, cities,
from the drawing board to
they're being planned the way a space capsule is planned, as a total human environment. No additional possibilities. Nothing more ever could be added.
Where are these going to be built?
One is in Maryland, halfway between Washington
and they're
Baltimore.
And one's,
yes, yeah.
One's in Irving,
and
California.
I suppose it is an accretion from either political or military structures and products that have to be made, and therefore the surround of the city follows this kind of pattern.
They're dealing with the city as if it were a container corporation dealing with cornflakes.
Yeah.
They deal with people as if they were cornflakes. They figure they can wrap them up, but good. And cut them off from all other contact, so they'll never be touched by the human hand or by human sounds. They will have no communication with the rest of the, say, the American environment. They will really be sealed off.
Really? They'll be, what is their
desire? Oh, well, it's a kind of prepared and controlled environment, you see. Pure art form. Dealing with the city as if it were a museum exhibition of some precious archaeological treasure. And just cut out all the impurities. Just have pure space around this thing.
These are going to be our new ghost towns.
Yeah. Because
it's like the Studio 8H at NBC.
Instead of Aspen.
It's the most useless place in the world for sound today. It was designed to isolate, to keep out sound. And these places sound like they're designed to keep out people.
Yeah.
Interestingly enough, and this might give us some reflection here, the first one, midway between Washington and Baltimore, is a political-military complex growing out of the extrusion from Washington and so on. The second one, Tony, is in California, they told us. Irvine,
California, 70 miles out of Los Angeles.
Which is a town built around a university which is in the process of being constructed now. The first blush of students moved in last fall, and they will begin to thrive and prosper. And the town, however, is being artfully and purposefully put around the university as the center of culture, of technology, of polity, and of learning. But what I'm driving at here is, in the contemporary scene, the two new cities, at least the ones that Time Inc. have taken for a kind of laboratory experiment or a 5 or 10 year concretive growth, have been a political military one and a university one. I think this in itself is a kind of commentary on what is happening today.
Yeah, and it's very much a theory of purity as opposed to natural mix. And just like your complaint about these sound studios, in which we're designed to keep sounds out, and these cities are designed to keep all life out
and all people in.
I just think very much of someone writing a script for life. And it's focusing on content rather than effect. And things built by desire and not by feeling, by other.
Well, there's nothing wrong with these things as purely experimental matters, but the peculiar.
Will they allow people to move away? I think that's the measure of whether.
Yes, they will. And we must concede the fact they agree, although somewhat reluctantly, that people will be allowed to work outside the immediate perimeters of the city. That most of the work will be carried on within the city proper, so that you will have a socio-industrial complex that is sufficient unto itself. But that certainly some of these people will be commuting to Washington or to Baltimore, as the case may be, even though they live within the new city.
You know, I wanted to mention something too that I mentioned to Ralph today. That was that I first began, although I've read you, and my thinking has been affected by your writing, actions were affected by your talk. I began to use you in my work from the day I heard you. On the first place was your film, but just hearing you, one or two of your lines reached me in a way that I could use. The writing reached me in a way I could think about.
Well, that figures, doesn't it? The written form is very much in that order.
And I, from that, I take the idea that we should begin to think of publishing you in sound.
I think this is something we ought to think about for all books, Tony. That with the coming of Xerox, books ought to acquire the auditory dimension. It's perfectly feasible. And you see, if you ever hear anybody... I'll never forget the time I first heard T.S. Eliot on recording. The disc, you know, on one side he read Grant Hill, on the other side he read The Hollow Man. And when you hear a poet for the first time, that changes everything about his poetry. His rhythms, his involvement in the language changes totally.
Right.
Same with Joyce reading from Anna Lippia.
You know, I've gone through this whole question of poetry and hearing it and so forth, and I begin to think that when you say you should hear poetry, they don't necessarily mean that you should hear someone else read it, but that you should hear it in your head as you read it, as opposed to reading it without verbalizing the words in your head. Poetry is meant to be heard by you in your head.
There's a book that you must have a look at by Francis Berry called The Physical Voice of Poetry. And it's a study of what must have been the sort of sound that the poets heard when they made their own poetry. That is, starting with Chaucer. this book studies what did these poets hear as they composed poetry. What they hear is their own voice in their own heads. This changes their poetry, but completely, depending on what sort of a physical voice they have. And Shelley, for example, had a very shrill voice. So shrill and so raucous that it put his friends off, that even his friends couldn't stand it. Tennyson, on the other hand, had a great booming,
oh, very Orson,
stentorian voice. It was a magnificent organ. And his readers don't get it.
And I'd love to play you this little piece I have. It's about 5 minutes long, on the sound and its relation to the letter form.
Good, let's hear it.
Would you like to hear it?
Love it. But you know, you must read this book. Get the title. It's called The Physical Voice of Poetry.
All right.
By Francis Berry, Berry. And I forgot who published it, but it's not an old. It's not an old book. It's a couple of, 3 years old. And
what was the book by Cage you told me about?
Silence.
Was it called Silence?
Yeah.
Just
Silence.
It's a short book, isn't it?
No, it's a fairly good sized book.
Oh, really? I mistake it.
Beautifully printed.
Well, yeah, okay.
Because I think it might help both of us. Their list, all sorts of things came to mind. And apropos of that, where we were earlier, there's a nice illustration of the effects of the written word on speech in Eliot's Wasteland. And it's the clue or cue comes from his use of the name Mrs. Equitone. But I heard when Eliot reads it, when he's recording the poem himself, and by the way, there's an area of study, the effects of the poet's recordings in our time have been tremendous. But when he records it, he simply reads the lines, "Tell dear Mrs. Equitone, I bring the horoscope myself. One must be so careful these days." You see, you mimic the effect of typography with the voice, Equitone. You see, even the voices on that tape are close to printing because of the equality. The amount of variation in rhythm and so on is slight compared to any... Well, you take Joyce's opening of his recitation. "Will you know, or don't you, Kenneth, or have it told you, every tellin' has a tailin', and that's the he and the she of it." Now, this is a non-literate speech. The brogues of the world, or dialects of the world, Negro or otherwise, are not affected by print. No leveling off of nuance and pattern, you see. That's why they can perform in the musical world so much more freely than the literate man. But this Mrs. Equitone is really a very useful bit because the whole British upper class mimic, with voice, they mimic the world of printing. This puts the lower classes way down because they still retain many of the characteristics of pre-print in their voices. So the class structure in England is quite simply simulating print with the voice. "Tell dear Mrs. Equitone, I bring the horoscope myself." Boy, does that fix people. It really, you know, puts the clamps on. It's comical, of course.
What would you say the effect of recording some poetry or the poets reading poetry has had?
Oh, well, it has involved readers in the whole poetic process as never before. Oh, heavens. When you actually hear Eliot or Joyce or Dylan Thomas reading that stuff, why, it makes you feel that it's a normal part of human speech and behavior to be poetic. Oh, sure. And I think you can really translate the word creative or poetic quite simply into probe, and that at all times any creative person is probing, exploring his environment. And the ordinary person doesn't probe. He reposes in the environment. He wraps it around himself like a familiar setting or chair or something. But the poet tends to be a bit of a delinquent, sleuth, Bogart, Bond, explorer. But I heard that Jack Benny show revived recently. Not a Fred Allen show. I'd like to hear a Fred Allen show again. What amazed me about the Jack Benny revival show was the tremendous speed with which he delivered his gags and his words. Very hi-fi, very fast. Whereas now, since TV, he's slowed down. He smiles slow. No hurry. The fast gag man of the radio days couldn't exist on TV.
You know, an interesting comparison of two shows. Norman Corwin did a thing called On a Note of Triumph. It was played, it was written to be played the night after the end of the war. It was all symbolic, all poetry and so forth. You listen to that today, it leaves you cold. You listen to an actuality broadcast of the British, that the British made, a whole series of records, you're as involved in that as if it were happening today. It's all reality material.
What sort of broadcaster was it, the reality broadcast?
Well, the reality broadcasts are interviews with the people on the battlefield, the sounds of the battle, and so forth. The other is poetry and music relating
well,
to
it. Well, it's packaged. The reality broadcasting, you see, isn't packaged. And packaging really means putting something around something. It's container corp. But in England, before the war, the thing grew up. Alec Comfort, the poet, was one of the inspirers of the movement called Mass Observation, in which the sort of reality broadcasting was done. They had teams of people who were simply going out, talking to people casually in ordinary situations about what was happening. And that idea of the informal, the unpackaged, but the Corwins, or the, who's the old voice of NBC, or from the Victory at Sea? Oh, who's he still around?
You're not thinking Merle and Friendly here. No.
The voice that they used on the Victory at Sea.
By the way, the Orson Welles broadcast of that invasion from Mars, I remember hearing it the night it was on, and I have a recording of that program that I listened to just a few months ago. It is so ridiculous and so uninvolving now, and yet it had the country in its clutches at that moment. There again is style.
Well, I'll come around to something like that in a moment. You know Glenn Gould.
I saw that piece, and I felt that he was searching for something, but he had so many errors in that. He was, he is still related to his performance of music. He was recognizing certain problems.
He feels that the concert hall, though, is not the right place for the performer anymore. But I'm sure he hasn't straightened out all the...
Yeah, aspects. But I don't think he's as free as Jimmy in saying, let's go out to the street bus terminal or let's...
Oh, quite true. Oh, he's still a very academic performer. One of the areas that we might be able to illustrate on June 27 would be the effect of sound on changing photographic methods. When sound movies came in, it changed the whole photographic pitch. And the difference we're talking about between radio and TV sound, between involving and uninvolving, is a difference between silence and talkies regarding the photography. The photography, as far as I've noticed, had to be stepped up to much higher intensity with sound. You see, when you're listening to sounds, you form as a visual track all the time. And when you're looking at pictures, you form a soundtrack all the time. The human being provides one.
Well, I bought Color TV last week, and I noticed a fantastic difference between the two. First off, I put the two of them in front of my daughter and asked which one would you like. She picks the color.
Uh-huh.
But apart from that, I find that the people that I used to watch the Johnny Carson show late at night, the people were celebrities on the black and white. On color, they're real people. I can see the shaving, I can see the skin, I see them as real people. I can see the color of their lips and so forth, as opposed to black and white, where I supply an image of them. I supply the rest of the image in my feelings.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that they are more real as people and less of this great figure with color.
By the way, there's a phrase, this might have some use.
Has the message changed?
My relation to it has changed.
First, it's a new medium.
It's much easier on my eyes.
Color is not the old medium. It's a brand new medium. It will change everything, including the content, in a short time. That's where Batman came from. The new color medium requires the cartoon world, not pictures. And you see, there's a phrase, well, TV.
Why do you say that?
Well, there's a phrase, what is called information theory. It's not a very useful phrase because it misleads people. Information theorists will say, in a photograph, there is no information, too many data. In a cartoon, lots of information, very few data. What they mean by information is structure, just outline. Now, TV is by comparison with photography, is information. It's cartoon.
Something you did at your Channel 13 thing gave me an idea that I felt would blow a certain type of commercial apart. Remember you had that drawing of the outline shapes of people and the numbers in them? Remember that one? You know, for instance, Life magazine will have a picture of 30 people, the graduating class of Cornell of 1914. Then they will have a little drawing of just the shapes of the people standing there with numbers and their names below it.
Yeah.
All right. You take these testimonial commercials, and you take and just have the outline of the person, and they're talking about how it cured their headache. You will find that people will be much more involved than seeing the person really in full camera, in full picture, telling about their headache. Because they can paint their own picture of the person the other way, in that shape. They will also find that it will not be a specific person, but it will be, if the sound is convincing and real, it will say that this is anybody and it's real. Whereas the other way, it becomes just one person and real. And it's a totally different...
But you see, the reason the kids will buy cartoons any time ahead of picture books is just that. So much has been left out. There's big space for them to get in.
Ambiguity. That's
another way of getting into the act. You see, the clear, distinct, precise scientific statement leaves no room for anybody to get in. Stay away. It excludes. Anything specialist and intense excludes. Now, the cartoon includes. And color includes even more than black and white because... You see, the eye, it is the periphery of the eye that sees black and white and movement. The center of the eye, the cones, see color. And that's much more involving than movement and black and white. So color will have a complete, transform the whole programming of TV eventually. And will change, it's a new environment too in the outside world. And,
it affects the way you see.
Have you watched a fire in black and white and a fire in color on TV?
No, I haven't seen anything like that. What do you mean, the fire?
A fire.
A
building burning down.
But it reminds me of Johnny Cage's remark, remember? When in trouble in New York, the cops told Johnny. You told me. Well, now look. I'd like to be able to track that down a little further, just in case.
So I told you that a cop one day told me that if you ask for if you yell help, if you're in a lobby and someone comes up and attacks you and you yell help, he says no one will come. He says yell fire and all the doors will open.
That's right. Now you see this is.
Attack,
I didn't do that. I wanted to bring out some.
Yeah. But you see,
images.
This is this is a nice way of getting it hot and cool. Yelling help is cool and is involving, and nobody wants to get involved anymore. They are already involved far too much. But if you say fire, they'll rush in because there's no involvement there. You just put the fire up and beat it.
Well, I saw it on another...
Literature is black and white. It's very hard to see color in literature. But Maxim Gorky has an essay on fire, and you see color in that entire goddamn essay.
Yeah, well, that could be.
Now, I would like to put
color.
The... image of a building burning down in color in front of your eyes in black and white, and I'd like to see how you react to that.
My reaction wouldn't be any different from anybody's reaction.
I have the idea that one is a danger you're staying away from.
It's literally the funny thing is here's a pun in a nonverbal form. The fire is really saying a very hot situation does not involve people. They get back. They don't feel involved. Help means you must hurry in here and involve yourself.
Well, that's only one aspect of what's going on. Because, look, realistically, if someone yells fire, I want to not be in danger. If they yell help, there's the chance of my being in danger.
Of course, but that's involvement. Now, when they yell help, that means they want you to get involved in their life.
Yes, the involvement I accept.
Well, no, most people don't accept it. They don't want to have anything to do with it.
What I mean by accepting is that I accept that part of your statement. The other part of the...
Fire? You mean you
come
might...
out because of the fire because they want to protect themselves.
But the protection takes the form of detaching themselves. Don't you see? As in any hot medium, you detach yourself. You become objective. You become a spectator. You don't get involved.
Yes, but
the more you hot up,
this house is burning down. I want to get the hell out of it.
That's not involvement. You see, it's a hot medium that you want to. That's all right. But that's true of all hot media. You want to get away from them.
Yeah.
That's the point. So the.
That's why they say shut off that radio.
Yeah, that's hot.
You want to get away from it.
Oh. But the reason that people will help with a fire is quite simply, of course, they don't want to get involved in a fire, in the sense that it might surround them. On the other hand, a fire is a very impersonal thing, whereas a person in need of help is in a very personal problem. And fire is not personal. It's purely objective. You rush in with an extinguisher or anything available, and you put it out. But there's no personal involvement.
How about fire as an object of art? Suppose I had a fire museum. You'd come in and immediately I'd be burning wood.
Yeah,
and then I'd
be
burning sulfur.
Wonderful.
It'd be a beautiful thing. I'd have every
A great spectrum of experiences. But, there's a great range of fire music.
Isn't it possible that we react to fire with feelings that we never knew we had before?
No, from the time you first burned your fingers, you have all sorts of feelings available for fire.
But isn't a feeling for fire something that might be handed down in our genes?
Oh, no. It may be, but it isn't necessary to suppose that. It's quite simply that physically you try to get away from it as much as possible. And any hot form of experience invites people to get away. By the way, there's a famous old story about the north wind and the sun decided to have a little battle about who could exert the most power on something. I remember this since I was literally in grade one. And the north wind blew like fury, and the guy merely tightened up his clothes on. Then the sun came out and beamed on him, and off went the clothes. But the hot is much more inclined to get people away, detached. Print is hot. It detaches people. Handwriting is not hot. It involves people. It's cool.
You know, I wanted to have a message on a commercial, and I just wanted to have the hand writing the message over the picture. Just writing it.
That's TV. The scanning finger is writing on the wall.
If you were to pick up a bottle on a shoreline, and you pulled out a typewritten message with the word help, you wouldn't be as involved as a handwritten message. I think it depends on the circumstance.
If you want to work at that, strictly, that's the red herring department, which you might well encounter on the seashore. But the bottle, you see, the message in a bottle is like something overheard, not heard. Something overheard.
Is that what we want in advertising?
Just a moment.
Wouldn't you drop in Life Magazine a handwritten ad
Just a moment. The overheard message, if you hear somebody in the barbershop saying something to somebody about something terrific, that has a far greater effect than somebody telling you something.
Would you let me do one of my columns in handwriting in your magazine?
Yes.
Okay, The overheard
is far more potent than what you hear. These awful noises that come off the commercials are so hot, they drive anybody to cover. And they should be cooled down, very cool.
You know, I have two other things that are interesting for you. This warden had a problem with too many guys wanting to go into solitary confinement.
This is like the Trappists. They now got guys who want to get off and be hermits.
So what they did the warden decide, you know, since everybody had bread and water, that the water would be served in baby bottles. And they cut down the guys that went into, you know, like 4% or something. The guys that wanted to go into, you know, did things that got them into solitary.
Why didn't they use diapers also for these guys?
Dress them in diapers and
great deterrent, indeed.
Well, you know Wingate Payne's office? Yeah. It's done in fur, wall to ceiling fur. He goes in there for about 20 minutes a day. Back to the womb.
Fur below.
Fire.
Fur away.
That's interesting. What's it sound like?
But look, they
want to try and interview him there?
So trying to think, Tony, for my benefit on June 27th, of some way of illustrating the effect of sound on pictures. In the section on movie, I do have a few observations on it, and pointed out that, what is, as far as I know, and never
well,
a chance
I have
to...
a beautiful way of showing this, exquisite way. I can take a scene where, I did this for the traffic commissioner, I have a scene where they show pictures that are cuts. The whole thing falls apart if you put the actual sound of what's happening there. The minute I put a church bell tolling against this, everything falls
into
place.
Wonderful. You know? By the way, notice that Bell, like for whom the bell tolls, Bell is a great big communal sound, all embracing, and has been so used for many centuries. It's a communal image for participation. It's not a message beamed at anybody. Oh, yeah, the little chapel bell, the high-pitched bell, that's an immediate message to a particular sector or segment, come now. But the big bell is not for that purpose. But, gee, that'll be great, Tony. That's what we need. I'm sure it would be possible from the library at Museum of Modern Art to have them extract the before and after effects in pictures. One of the things, you see, the Russians have never been able to make pictures since talkies. They were the great maestros of film as art in the days of the silence. They are themselves a very ear-oriented people, and when sound came in, it intensified the visual image to a point that they found utterly uncongenial, and they never did make pictures again. They still haven't made pictures since sound. And they are, however, beginning to make pictures with higher visual intensity and may eventually begin to experiment again with pictures. But it was only at a certain level of sensory mix, as it were, that they could be experimental with film.
Did you want a comment from Marshall in the annual?
She would like it.
You want to tell him what you'd want? Say something in this
relation? Does he want to finish with his notes? I'm just fascinated by what this triggered in his mind.
I'm just running through a few notes, but what were you going to suggest?
We have an annual, I don't know if you were.
And this is an annual for which enterprise?
Photography,
I see.
John is the editor of Popular Photography.
I see.
You'll send Marshall a subscription.
Sure. I think you have one coming up there.
Good.
I was a fellow who wrote you a note saying I would trade you Tony for.
I haven't been home since then, as it were. I haven't really sat.
You got to him before.
Yeah, I haven't sat down at home really since that time. I did get to look at your note. I didn't realize it was the same guy. But well, anyway, you were going to.
We also did the editorial on you, Soup for Breakfast.
Oh?
I don't know if you're aware of that.
No, I don't know. But what had you in mind then for the annual, or possibly?
I was intrigued and baffled by your chapter, Photography, the Brothel Without Walls.
No, that was movie. Not photo.
Have you reread the chapter lately? You don't pinpoint it.
No, a movie, Brothel Without Walls, but that was the subheading of the movie chapter. Not the that was. I forgot what the subhead of the photo chapter was. Wasn't brothel.
Photography, the brothel without walls.
And not, what did I have for movies then?
Is there a copy?
You had a copy.
Oh, well.
Well, I went across the United States in a flying short course, and I probably sold more damn books to people who hate me now from reading it, getting very upset about what's happening in the world of vision. And I used quotes out of this thing. Now, the brothel without walls had me thoroughly baffled.
Oh, well.
And
it was based on some observations made by Rennie Clarke in which he pointed to the strange power of the photograph or the movie to penetrate the world of flesh and the textures of flesh. And so this is a very brothel-like dimension, the working with flesh and textures. As the movie, paradoxically, as the photo has improved, it has become less and less visual and more tactile, textural. The more hi-fi you go with pictures, the more you get textured surfaces. You penetrate wood, cloth, stone. You do a hi-fi study of stone, and you don't get visual, you get tactile imagery. In the world of flesh, the photograph is, in that sense, brothel. Is that what it sells? Brothel?
Well, the photograph, brothel without walls.
Yeah. What do I have for movies?
Well, I'm looking for the movie. Movies, the real world, R.E.D.
Ah, okay. I forgot. I never open a book again once it's published.
Well,
I never do.
I can sympathize with you. I have one of those, too. Now, if the movie is a brothel without worlds, what is a still photograph?
You're still talking about photography as a brothel, yeah.
Yeah, well, this is what...
I know. We're not talking about that still.
All right. You said that the brothel without walls concerns motion picture, and here it is, the photograph.
The brothel. It concerns it in the sense of flesh textures. You can penetrate, and there is no privacy conceivable or possible with photograph. It invades. As the telephone invades the ear world anywhere, the photo can invade any part of human life, inside the body, outside the body, so on. And it's simply this invasion of textures and surfaces that is in question. You understand that these statements are intended to be very controversial. I never make a statement as just a nice packaged piece of information about anything. I would never bother to say anything like that.
I accept it as such, and I admire you for it.
But I do it deliberately and experimentally.
Well, and that an English teacher should lead us in visual communications is just fascinating.
Oh, well.
And I doubt that you've ever made a film or taken a picture.
Not especially. I've taken a few, sure.
Come in as the critic of our area, and in that you're raising the questions in our mind, and you're very important for this, but
please.
Is the Canadian the leader in the image world today? The Canadian is a mass figure based on...
I should doubt it. We have a mounted policeman up there, and that's about all. And the Dulac. Don't forget the Dulac.
McLaren, the Canadian Film Board movies,
Norrie Frye,
Film Board and Stills.
Norrie Frye, the archetypal expert.
An American, a Frenchman, and an Englishman across your photo exhibit at Expo 67.
Well, that's, you know, that they would never draw on local talent for anything that they wanted for exotic effect. The natural. However, who cares? But that's nothing paradoxical about that. Hey, I want to tell you something. I've got a lot of other notes here. We've got to get going, you see. We have an appointment. But here is one that may have some meaning. It happened a few days ago in Toronto. A little picture in the paper. Some school kids had got together, dug up some money from the class, and they bought an out-of-door Ruddy Coaster sign on which they had written, "Happiness is having Miss McKeon and Mr. Pratt," their English teacher and their history teacher, both of whom were leaving the school. They put this on a big public sign right out on Bathurst Avenue, which is sort of a big thoroughfare. I was struck by this as a lyric personal use of a public medium. I knew it was going to happen sooner or later. I never heard of it happening before. It's like taking a Coke ad and turning it into a personal sonnet to one's wife. And using a public forum for private expression. Now, this comes naturally to this TV generation. They're not the least bit inhibited by public media. They accept them as their personal language. Private.
I did the tribute to my mother when she died on radio. On my program the next morning.
There is an American film with Judy Holliday in which she buys a billboard in Times Square and puts her own name on it to become famous.
I remember that.
Someone has used this as a way of getting his wife to come back to him, use the billboard.
Yeah. Well, it's like the English, come to think of it, have used the front page of the Times for many years for personals, strictly personal information. Come back and all will be forgiven. On page one of the Times, they've used, in other words, news, public news, as private message. But they've suddenly dropped it after many, many years,
Marshall,
which is a great mistake.
Suppose I give you two pages of our magazine and pay you for it to do a want ad page for what you expect of the visual and sound people of our time. Would you do it?
Gee, it'd be nice if I could get some of these other books written first. I'm not going to take on any more assignments until I've got my obligations attended to. I really have tremendous, a lot of work get done.
What were some of the other points?
Apropos of your idea of world as studio, look in the same way at the total world environment as campus for learning. Dialogue can now take place, again, with the aids of the tape recorder type, anywhere in the world. Any part, under the water, above the earth. Well, look how much human interest is now coming out of these capsules. Anything said in that environment is top human interest. But human interest, by the way, means involvement, as opposed to a news story. A story is not human interest. That is, an ordinary news story is not human interest. It has to have a certain dimension for involvement, where you can complete the rest of the factors yourself. This is true in pictures. You see, the pictures that permit a high degree of fill-in, like that one, you see, larger portrait there, compared to the snapshots up there, there's much more to fill in photographically with your senses. It's more abstract. Abstract art means leaving a lot of things out so that you can get into the picture.
You know, I'm struck by something very unusual. You always go like this when you say involved.
Yeah, because...
Now, wait.
Telescope.
I walk down the street, and when I see guys go like this, I think of the same that, you know, and it's the same involvement in a way. You know, I mean, it's a very involving situation.
Yeah.
No, I'm serious.
Yeah.
There is the involvement in both situations.
Well, when people do gesture, it is because they are using all the senses at once. You know, they've discovered that kids with reading difficulties can be helped by getting them on the trampoline. And when they get using all their muscles, that can overcome visual difficulties. That merely when they're trying to isolate one of their senses, they get into troubles that they can overcome by using all their senses. Well, in many of these backward territories like France and Italy, they use all their senses. They gesticulate wildly.
Gee, that's fascinating. That explains something. In Wall Street Journal this week, there's a item about a golf school, a famous golf school. They will sell you for $499 a movie camera and give you instructions in being a photographer so you can take your own picture. So maybe through the vision, making a movie, you can become a better golfer.
That's right. I'm sure you could. It's by feedback. You see, what happens, feedback is a form of profound involvement. Anything that loops back and brings you into the whole process again.
I said today in a commercial we work on, make a mistake and leave it in. I say, first off, we get the client interested by doing it.
Yeah.
But let's leave it in the commercial. Make a mistake that doesn't affect us. People will be calling in, be involved in this commercial.
You see, the correctness is mechanical. Any correct flowing performance is purely mechanical compared to a mistake.
Let's put the dropping of the sound of the dropping of the lid 4 seconds later.
Oh, here's one for you.
Well,
there's a chap at Rochester who had the curiosity to put a mic in the crib of a small infant to pick up all the sounds that a small infant hears.
I have that. I've done that. All the talk that people speak to.
Well, but listen, guess what? Guess what came out?
The icebox.
The icebox door is the overwhelming sound that any small child hears. Not traffic, not voices. The icebox. Clunk. Over and over again. Yeah, how about that?
What were some of the other points?
It's an environmental sound. Greek movies. Have you ever watched one? Like Electra or Medea? Well, there are quite a few modern Greek movies, and try one, and you'll find that they do them, these tragedies, out of doors, the way we do Westerns. And they at once become plausible. Tragic emotions make sense at once you get out of an enclosed theatrical space into the out-of-doors. The form of the emotion then becomes environmental. It isn't just private anymore. It becomes a typical role-like emotion. It really is a very great experience. Now, our Westerns, you see, have that power of using the out-of-doors, unenclosed space for shaping emotion. It's like your clarinetist. By using the out-of-doors for the shaping of emotion, they come up with a pattern of emotion that people find immediately plausible, meaningful, involving. Now, no legit theater has this resource. It can't go near that dimension of legitimate tragic emotion. So that the Westerns, the out-of-door shows, have a tremendous lot of resources utterly untouched by the indoor theater or indoor movie. And, they don't have sets, you see. In the Greek movies, there are no sets. They just use the damn rocks and the ground. And just as in a Western, there are no sets, except when they rush into town, eh? But, dimension, the changing of the image, photographic or in any sense, by getting away from enclosed spaces. And same with sound, really. You were explaining that you get away from the enclosed and the sound takes on a new dimension altogether. There's a tremendous world for you to keep in mind. You probably have thought about it. Linguistics. In terms of the creative use of the tape recorder, the whole science of linguistics has come out of it. Because with the tape recorder, it became possible to arrest, isolate certain rhythms, patterns, and study them, play them back. Linguistics is a study not of semantics or word meanings, but of gestures and rhythms of language. A complete new dimension of speech has opened up with the tape recorder. And now it becomes possible to know why children are able to learn their mother tongue in 3 or 4 years. Because the kids don't approach objects by semantics. It isn't the meaning of words that they first get, it's the rhythm, the patterns of syntax and so on. They don't get it grammatically or by understanding what it means. They get it by straight involvement in the rhythm and by using that rhythm themselves then as a toy to play around the world with. They try it out, they repeat it. So, linguistics, which is a pretty exciting world of new study, came straight out of tape recording. Impossible without it. And, of course, without the mobility and portability of the tape recorder, you couldn't do linguistic study. But I just scribbled those down as we went, but there's lots that...
They haven't begun to use the... Interestingly, they don't use the recorder as a creative tool in the study of linguistics yet. Very few people. I mean, I imagine it's one in a million that puts the recorder in the crib to see what the
person says. Oh, yeah, that's right.
They're using it in the school, in the classroom, in a confined little box that the person sits in the space capsule. And that's where the study...
Make a note of this book. I think you'd find a lot of interest in it. It's called The Lore and Language of School Children by Mr. and Mrs. Opie, O-P-I-E. I think it's Oxford Press. But it's a study of the actual songs, games, phrases, slang, jokes, gags, everything that kids use in the schoolyard. Now, when they began this study, or rather the result of the study, they discovered that in Melbourne, Australia, or Belfast, Ireland, or in the Bronx, the same jokes, games, gags, and the same as had been going on for centuries, because these things are not taught by adults to children, but by children to children.
Yes, I say that in the collection of folklore, I say the transmission era is 2 or 3 years as opposed to the generation, because it's from kid to kid rather from adult to
but
child.
But the paradox is that it's static. It never changes. This oral form is very conservative.
If we were to follow this, you would destroy the grammar textbook as Well, the word hot to a child is a noun. Stove is an adjective.
No, but look, no child ever made a mistake in slang. You only make a mistake...
It's not slang, it's meaning. The word hot is more important than what the object that is
oral.
Hot to a child.
Grammatical errors begin with the written word. When you try to translate the spoken word into written form, there are masses of grammatical errors in the translation. When you merely stick with the spoken word, slang, no mistakes. Now, slang is not easy. It's tricky, it's subtle, it's full of nuance, but no child ever made a mistake. It's like saying no native ever made a mistake in grammar.
You know, it's interesting. This fits into
anthropologists make mistakes in grammar, but natives don't make grammatical errors.
This is interesting. This fits into your idea that you can take the new furniture and you can't take the new furniture and put it into the old, but you can take the old furniture and put it into the new.
That's right.
In that...
That's the rearview mirror.
You can take any speech and it's correct grammatically, and yet the if you took and said what was written, you can make mistakes.
That's right, because if you ask the kids to write down their slang, they couldn't do it. It's translating from sound into sight that creates the grammatical problem. Well, your question then is more or less in that area. As we move more and more into a sound world, the boundaries between sight and sound, or written and oral, tend to disappear. More and more. In the same way with photography, it can go across boundaries of any kind. The boundaries that previously of public and private disappear. It invades areas that previously were inviolate, and creates new environment of awareness and imagery.
I wish you weren't so committed to some of these projects, because I'd like to expose you to some people in the photo site. For instance, Bruce Davidson, he just completed a project with his students in making a visual vote for Lindsay. They translated why they voted for him with a camera to be stuck in under his nose to see if he's accomplished this.
And what happened as a result? What did they turn up with?
It's about to happen in the second stage now. There's such fascinating overlaps between sound, between politics and all the things we're talking about. And everybody in New York has a little hand, not often.